again the military cemetery, with its long lines of graves, but somehow the sunflowers looked different now. They were facing in another direction. The evening sunshine gave them a reddish tinge, and they trembled gently in the breeze. They seemed to be whispering to each other. Were they horrified by the ragged men who were marching past on tired feet? The colors of the sunflowers, orange and yellow, gold and brown, danced before my eyes. They grew in a fertile brown soil from carefully tended mounds, and behind them grew gnarled trees forming a dark background, and above everything, the deep blue clear sky. As we neared camp, the askaris gave the order to sing and to march in step and proper formation. The commandant might be watching the return of his prisoners, and he insisted they must always march out singing, and apparently happy, and return in the same way. The askaris had to help him to keep up the pretense. We must radiate contentment, and singing was part of it. Woe to us if our performance did not satisfy the commandant. We suffered for it. The askaris, too, would have nothing to laugh at. After all, they were only Russians. Luckily, the commandant was nowhere to be seen, so we marched into camp behind another working party unobserved and fell in on the parade ground for roll call. I saw Arthur in another column and waved to him furtively. I was dying to tell him about my experience in the hospital, and also to tell Josek. I wondered what these two men, so different from each other, would have to say. I also wanted to talk to them about the sunflowers. Why had we never noticed them before? They had been in flower for weeks. Had nobody noticed them? Or was I the only person for whom they had any significance? We were lucky. Roll call was over sooner than usual, and I touched Arthur on the shoulder.
Well, how was it? Hard work?
He smiled at me in a friendly way. Not so bad. Do you know where I was?
No. How should I know?
At the technical high school.
Really? But in a different capacity than formerly.
You may well say that.
You look rather depressed,
Arthur remarked. I did not reply. The men were crowding toward the kitchen, and soon we were standing in a queue waiting for the food issue. Josek came past us with his mess tin full. He nodded to us. We sat on the steps in front of the hut door, eating our food, and on the parade ground stood groups of prisoners telling each other of the day's happenings. Some of them perhaps had succeeded in scrounging oddments during their work outside the camp, and they were now exchanging these among each other. My gaze wandered to the pipe, a narrow, fenced passage running round the inner camp and ending at the sandhills, where the executions usually took place. Sometimes men waited for 2 or 3 days in the pipe before they were murdered. The SS fetched them out of the huts or arrested them in the city, where they had been in hiding. They operated a rational system of shooting a number of men together, so several days would sometimes pass before the number was large enough to warrant the SS executioner's effort to make his way to the sandhills. On that particular evening, there was nothing to be seen in the pipe. Arthur told me why.
There were 5 today, but they had not long to wait. Kauser fetched them. A fellow in our hut knew them, and said they had been unearthed in a good hiding place in the city.
Arthur spoke calmly and quietly, as if he was recounting something very commonplace.
There was a boy among them,
he continued after a while, and now his voice was a little more emotional.
He had lovely fair hair. He didn't look the slightest bit Jewish. If his parents had put him into an Aryan family, he would never have been noticed.
I thought of Eli. Arthur, I must talk to you. In the high school, which they are now using as a military hospital, I had an experience today which I am not finished with. You might laugh at me when you hear it, but I want to know just what you think about it. I have faith in your judgment.
Go on, he said.
No, not now. We will talk about it later. I want Josek to be there to hear it. Was I right, after all, to tell them what had happened? I thought of the 5 men in the pipe who had been shot that day. Was this SS man more to me than they were,
Perhaps it was better to keep my mouth shut about what I had heard in the hospital death chamber. I feared that Arthur, the cynic, might say, "Just look at him. He can't forget a dying SS man, while countless Jews are tortured and killed every hour." He might add, "You have let yourself be infected by the Nazis. You are beginning to think that the Germans are in some way superior. And that's why you are worrying about your dying SS man." This would hurt me, and then no doubt Arthur would tell me about the unspeakable crimes that the Nazis had committed. I would be ashamed of myself. So perhaps it was better to keep to myself what had happened in the hospital. I strolled over to the parade ground and chatted to some acquaintances. Suddenly one of them hissed, "Six!" That was the agreed warning that SS men were approaching. I hurried back to Arthur and sat down by him as the two SS men walked to the bandsman's hut.
"What were you going to tell us?" asked Arthur.
"I have been thinking it over, and I don't want to talk about it. You might not understand, or..."
"Or what? Tell us," Arthur insisted.
I was silent.
"All right, as you like."
Arthur stood up. He seemed annoyed. But 2 hours later, I told them the story. We were sitting in our stuffy hut on our bunks. I told them about our march through the city and about the sunflowers. "Have either of you ever noticed them?"
"Of course I have," said Josek. "What is so special about them?"
I was reluctant to tell him the impression the sunflowers had made on me. I could not say I had envied the dead Germans their sunflowers, or that I had been seized with a childish longing to have a sunflower of my own. Arthur joined in.
"Well, sunflowers are something to please the eye. The Germans, after all, are great romantics. But flowers aren't much use to those rotting under the earth. The sunflowers will rot away like them. Next year there won't be a trace, unless someone plants new ones. But who knows what's going to happen next year," he added scornfully.
I continued my story. I described how the nurse had fetched me and taken me to the dean's room, and then I told them in detail of the dying SS man by whose bed I had sat for hours, and of his confession. To the child who had leaped to death with his father, I gave the name of Eli.
"How did the man know the child's name?" asked one of them.
"He didn't. I gave him the name because it reminded me of a boy in the Lemberg ghetto." They all seemed grimly fascinated by my story, and once when I paused to gather my thoughts, they urged me to go on. When I finally described how the dying man had pleaded with me to pardon his crime, and how I had left him without saying a word, I noticed a slight smile appear on Josek's face. I was sure it signified his agreement with my action, and I nodded to him. It was Arthur who first broke the silence.
"One less," he exclaimed.
The two words expressed exactly what we all felt in those days, but Arthur's reaction somehow disturbed me. One of the men, Adam, he seldom wasted words, said thoughtfully, "So you saw a murderer dying. I would like to do that 10 times a day. I couldn't have enough such hospital visits." I understood his cynicism. Adam had studied architecture, but had had to abandon his career when the war broke out. During the Russian occupation, he worked on building sites. All his family possessions had been nationalized by the Russians. When in the summer of 1940 the great wave of deportations to Siberia began, embracing all of bad social origin, that is, especially members of the well-to-do classes, he and his family had hidden for weeks. At our first meeting after his arrival in the camp, he had said, "You see, it was worthwhile hiding from the Russians. If they had caught me, I should now be in Siberia. As it is, I am still in Lemberg. Whether this may be an advantage..." He was completely indifferent to his surroundings. His fiancée was in the ghetto, but he rarely had news from her. She must have been working in some army formation. His parents, to whom he was deeply devoted, had perished in the very first days after the German occupation. Sometimes, in his disregard for his surroundings, he seemed to me like a sleepwalker. He grew more and more remote, and at first we could not rightly understand why.
but gradually we all came to resemble him. We, too, had lost most of our relatives. My story had apparently roused Arthur a little from his apathy, but for a long time nothing more was said by any of my listeners. Then Arthur got up and went to a bunk where a friend of his was retailing the radio news, and the others went about their own business. Only Jacek stayed with me. "Do you know," he began, "when you were telling us about your meeting with the SS man, I feared at first that you had really forgiven him. You would have had no right to do this in the name of people who had not authorized you to do so. What people have done to you yourself, you can, if you like, forgive and forget. That is your own affair. But it would have been a terrible sin to burden your conscience with other people's sufferings." "But aren't we a single community with the same destiny, and one must answer for the other?" I interrupted. "Be careful, my friend," continued Jacek. "In each person's life there are historic moments which rarely occur, and today you have experienced one such. It is not a simple problem for you. I can see you are not entirely pleased with yourself, but I assure you that I would have done the same as you did. The only difference, perhaps, is that I would have refused my pardon quite deliberately and openly, and yet with a clear conscience. You acted more unconsciously. And now you don't know whether it was right or wrong. But believe me, it was right. You have suffered nothing because of him, and it follows that what he has done to other people, you are in no position to forgive." Jacek's face was transfigured.
"I believe in Haolam Emes, in life after death, in another better world, where we will all meet again after we are dead. How would it seem then if you had forgiven him? Would not the dead people from Dnipropetrovsk come to you and ask, 'Who gave you the right to forgive our murderer?'"
I shook my head thoughtfully. "Jacek," I said, "you make it all sound so simple, probably because your faith is strong. I could argue with you for hours, although I would not want to alter my actions, even if I could. I will only say one thing, and I am anxious to know what you think. The fellow showed a deep and genuine repentance. He did not once try to excuse what he had done. I saw that he was really in torment." Jacek interrupted. "Such torment is only a small part of his punishment." "But," I continued, "he has no time left to repent or atone for his crimes." "What do you mean by atone for?"
Now he had me where he wanted me. I had no reply. I dropped the argument and tried another gambit.
"This dying man looked on me as a representative, as a symbol of the other Jews, whom he could no longer reach or talk to. And moreover, he showed his repentance entirely of his own accord. Obviously he was not born a murderer, nor did he want to be a murderer. It was the Nazis who made him kill defenseless people."
"So, you mean you ought to have forgiven him after all?" At this juncture, Arthur came back. He had heard only Jacek's last sentence, and in his quiet voice he said, "A superman has asked a subhuman to do something which is superhuman. If you had forgiven him, you would have never forgiven yourself all your life."
"Arthur," I said, "I have failed to carry out the last wish of a dying man. I gave him no answer to his final question."
"But surely you must know there are requests that one cannot and dare not grant. He ought to have sent for a priest of his own church. They would have soon come to an agreement."
Arthur's words were delicately, almost imperceptibly ironical. "Why," I asked, "is there no general law of guilt and expiation? Has every religion its own ethics, its own answers?"
"Probably, yes."
There was nothing more to say. What in those circumstances, in those terrible times, could be said, had been said. The subject dropped. To distract our thoughts, Arthur told us about the news that he had heard, but his words met with only half my attention. In thought, I was still in the death chamber of the German hospital. Perhaps Arthur was wrong. Perhaps his idea of the Superman asking a subhuman for something superhuman was not more than a phrase which sounded very enlightened, but was no real answer.
The SS man's attitude toward me was not that of an arrogant Superman.
Probably I hadn't successfully conveyed all my feelings. A subhuman condemned to death at the bedside of an SS man condemned to death. Perhaps I hadn't communicated the atmosphere and the despair at his crime so clearly expressed in his words.
And suddenly, I was assailed by a doubt as to the reality of all this. Had I actually been in the dean's room that day? It all seemed to me doubtful and unreal, as our whole existence in those days. It could not have been all true. It was a dream, induced by hunger and despair. It was too illogical, like the whole of our lives. The prisoner in the camp was driven, and he had to learn to let himself be driven without a will of his own. In our world, nothing any longer obeyed the laws of normal everyday life. Here, everything had its own logic. What laws were still valid in captivity? The only law that was left as a reliable basis for judgment was the law of death. That law alone was logical, certain, and irrefutable. All other laws paled into insignificance. The result was a general passivity. We constantly reminded ourselves that this was the one law that was inevitable, that one could do nothing to change it. The effect on us was a mental paralysis, and the inconsolable attitude in which we were enveloped was the clear expression of the hopelessness of our lot.
During the night I saw Eli. His face seemed paler than ever, and his eyes expressed the dumb, eternally unanswered question, why? His father brought him to me in his arms. As he approached, he covered his eyes with his hands. Behind the two figures raged a sea of flames from which they were fleeing. I wanted to take Eli, but all that existed was a bloody mess.
What are you shouting about? You will bring the guards in.
Arthur shook me by the shoulders. I could see his face by the weak light bulb high above on the ceiling. I was not yet fully awake. Before my eyes danced something resembling a bandaged head with yellow stains. Was that too a dream? I saw everything as if through frosted glass.
I will bring you a glass of water. Perhaps you are feverish, said Arthur as he shook me again.
And then I looked him full in the face.
Arthur,
I stammered. Arthur, I don't want to go on that working party to the hospital tomorrow.
First of all, he replied, it is already today. And secondly, you could perhaps get attached to another party. I will go to the hospital in your place.
Arthur was trying to calm me. He talked as if I were a child.
Are you suddenly frightened to look death in the eye just because you have seen an SS man dying? How many Jews have you seen killed? Did that make you shout out in the night? Death is our constant companion, have you forgotten that? It doesn't even spare the SS. You had just gone to sleep when the guards came in and fetched one of us away, the man sleeping right at the back in the corner. They took him only as far as the door of the hut, and then he collapsed. He was dead. Wake up properly and come with me. Look at him, and then you will understand that you are making too much fuss about your SS man.
Why did Arthur stress your SS man? Did he mean to hurt me? He noticed the way I flinched.
Fine feelings nowadays are a luxury we can't afford, neither you nor I.
Arthur, I repeated, I don't want to go back to the hospital.
If they send you there, you'll have to go. There's nothing you can do. Many will be only too pleased not to stay in the camp all day.
Arthur still seemed unable to understand me.
I haven't told you about the people in the streets. I don't want to see any of them anymore, and they mustn't see me either. I don't want their sympathy.
Arthur gave up. He turned round in his bunk and went to sleep. I tried to keep awake. I feared the dream would return. But then I suddenly saw the men in the street, and I realized that the break with the world around us was now complete. They did not like us Jews. And that was no new thing. Our fathers had crept out of the confines of the ghetto into the open world. They had worked hard and done all they could to be recognized by their fellow creatures.
but it was all in vain. If the Jews shut themselves away from the rest of the world, they were foreign bodies. If they left their own world and conformed, then they were undesirable immigrants to be hated and rejected. Even in my youth, I realized that I had been born a second-class citizen. A wise man once said that the Jews were the salt of the earth. But the Poles thought that their land had been ruined by oversalting. Compared with Jews in other countries, therefore, we were perhaps better prepared for what the Nazis had in store for us, and perhaps we were thereby made more resistant. From birth onward, we had lived with the Poles, grown up with them, gone to school with them, but nevertheless to them we were always foreigners. A bridge of mutual understanding between a Jew and a non-Jew was a rarity, and nothing had changed in that respect, even though the Poles were now themselves subjugated. Even in our common misery, there were still barriers between us. I no longer wanted even to look at Poles. In spite of everything, I preferred to stay in camp. Next morning we assembled again for roll call. I was hoping that Arthur would accompany me if I had to go back to the hospital, and if the nurse came to fetch me again, I would ask her to take Arthur in my place. The commandant arrived. He was not always present at the roll call. Yesterday, for instance, he had not been there. He brought with him a large black Doberman on a lead. By him stood the officer, who was calling the roll, and other SS men. First of all, the prisoners were counted. Luckily, the figure was correct. Then the commandant ordered, "Working parties fall in, as yesterday." There was considerable confusion. The prisoners were supposed to fall in according to huts, not working parties. The rearrangement into working parties was not quick enough for the commandant. He began to bellow. The dog became restless and strained on its lead. Any moment the commandant would let it loose. But again we were lucky. An officer came over from the commandant's office with a message. Whatever it was, he marched off with the dog, which saved us the usual gruesome scenes and the aftermath of wounded and perhaps a few dead. The band at the inner gate played a lively march as we moved off. SS men watched our ranks intently. From time to time they made a man fall out because he was conspicuous in some way or other. Perhaps he was not in step, or perhaps he looked weaker than the others. He was then sent to the pipe. We were escorted by the same askaris as on the previous day. An SS man from the guard room placed himself at the head of our column. On the way, I wondered where I could hide if the nurse came to look for me. The cemetery with the sunflowers came into view again on our left. Soon the dying SS man in the hospital would join his comrades there. I tried to picture the spot reserved for him. Yesterday my comrades had stared at the sunflowers as if spellbound, but today they seemed to disregard them. Only a few glanced at them, but my gaze traversed row after row, and I nearly stumbled over the heels of the man in front of me. In Gradeska Street, children were playing unconcernedly. They, at least, did not need to hide when a man in uniform appeared. How lucky they were! My neighbor drew my attention to a passerby. "Do you see that fellow with the Tyrolean hat? The one with the feather?" "Certainly a German," said I. "Sort of. He is now a racial German, but 3 years ago he was a fanatical Pole. I know him well. I lived near him. When the Jewish shops were looted, he was there, and when they beat up the Jews in the university, he was there too. Moreover, he is sure to have volunteered when the Russians were looking for collaborators. He is the type who is always on the side of the people in power. Probably he has raked up a German ancestor from somewhere or other, but I am prepared to bet that he could not speak a word of German until a short time ago. The Nazis need people like him. They would be helpless without them." In fact, one constantly heard of ethnic Germans striving to make themselves 150% German. On working parties, one had to be careful to avoid them. They were always anxious to prove they were earning their special ration cards. Many of them tried to cover their imperfect knowledge of German by being particularly beastly to Poles and Jews. The existence of Poles and Jews to be victimized was very welcome to them. When we entered the courtyard of the technical high school, the Askaris at once lay down on the grass and rolled their fat cigarettes. Two lorries were already waiting for us prisoners. The refuse containers were again full to overflowing. There were shovels against a wall, and each of us took one. I tried to get a job on the trucks, where the nurse would be unlikely to find me, but an orderly had already chosen four other men for the job. Then I saw the nurse walking from one prisoner to another, glancing at each of them. Was it going to be a repetition of yesterday? Had the dying Nazi forgotten something? Suddenly she was standing in front of me.
"Please," she said, "come with me." "I have to go on working here," I protested.
She turned to the orderly who was in charge of us and said a few words to him. Then she pointed to me and came back.
"Put down your shovel," she said curtly, "and come with me."
I followed her with fear in my heart. I could not bear to listen to another confession. It was beyond my powers. Most of all, I feared that the dying man would renew his plea for forgiveness. Perhaps this time I would be weak enough to give in, and so finish with the painful business. But to my surprise, the nurse took a different route from yesterday's. I had no idea where she was taking me. Perhaps to the mortuary? She searched among a bunch of keys and unlocked a door. We entered a room which looked as if it were used for storage. On wooden stands, which stretched nearly to the ceiling, bundles and boxes were piled.
"Wait here," she ordered. "I will be back in a moment."
I stood still. After a few moments, she came back. In her hand, she had a bundle tied up in a green ground sheet. Sewn to it was a piece of linen with an address. Somebody passed along in the corridor. She looked around nervously and drew me into the storeroom. Then she gazed at me searchingly and said, "The man with whom you spoke yesterday died in the night. I had to promise to give you all his possessions, except for his confirmation watch, which I am to send to his mother."
"I don't want anything, sister. Send the lot to his mother."
Without a word, she thrust the bundle at me, but I refused to touch it.
"Please, send it all to his mother. The address is on it."
The nurse looked at me uncertainly. I turned away and left her there. She did not try to hold me back. Apparently, she had no inkling of what the SS man had told me on the previous day. I went back to work in the courtyard. A hearse drove past. Were they taking away the SS man already?
"Are you over there? You're asleep," shouted the orderly.
An Askari heard him and came over flourishing a whip. In his eyes there was a sadistic gleam, but the orderly sent him away. This time our midday meal was not provided by the hospital. The ordinary prisoner's food was brought to us from the camp, an evil-smelling gray brew misnamed soup. We swallowed it ravenously. Soldiers stood around watching us as if we were animals being fed. For the rest of the day I worked in a trance. When I was back again on the parade ground in the evening, I could hardly remember the return march. I had not even glanced at the sunflowers. Later, I told my friends about the death of the SS man, but they were not interested. The whole incident was closed in their minds after the tale I had told them the day before. But they all agreed with me that I had done well to refuse the dead man's possessions. Josek said, "In the story you told us yesterday, there were points that seemed to need further thought. I should have liked to discuss them with Reb Shlomo, but he, alas, is no more. He could easily have proved to you that you acted rightly. But even so, I am afraid that you will continue to worry about this business. But don't cudgel your brains over it. You had no right to forgive him. You could not forgive him, and it was quite right not to accept his things." After a while, he added, "The Talmud tells us." Arthur lost something of his otherwise unshakable self-possession. He said to Josek,
"Don't make him any madder. He is already dreaming about it and shouting out in his sleep. Next time it may bring us misfortune. It only needs one of the guards to hear him shouting, and he will put a bullet through him. It's happened before."
"And you," said Arthur, turning to me, "do stop talking about it.
All this moaning and groaning leads to nothing. If we survive this camp, and I don't think we will, and if the world comes to its senses again, inhabited by people who look on each other as human beings, then there will be plenty of time to discuss the question of forgiveness. There will be votes for and against. There will be people who will never forgive you for not forgiving him. But anyhow, nobody who has not had our experience will be able to understand fully. When we here argue about the problem, we are indulging in a luxury which we in our position simply cannot afford. Arthur was right. I could see that. That night I slept soundly, without dreaming of Eli. At the morning roll call, the inspector from the Eastern Railway was waiting for us. We could return to our former work. Over 2 years passed, years filled with suffering and constant specter of death. Once I myself was about to be shot, but I was saved by a miracle. And so I know the thoughts which a man has in the moments before death. Arthur was no longer alive. He died in my arms during an epidemic of typhus. I held him fast as he lay in the death struggle, and I wiped the foam from his lips with a cloth. In his last hours, fever made him unconscious, mercifully for him. Then one day Adam sprained his ankle at work. As he was marching out with his working party, the guard noticed he was limping. He was sent off at once to the pipe, and there he waited 2 days before he and others were shot. Josek, too, is dead, but I only heard about this much later. Our group had been posted to the Eastern Railway and quartered there, and one day some extra labor was sent over from the camp. Among them was Josek. I could look after him a bit now. We had some contact with the outside world, and we got more food. I begged our head Jew to arrange for Josek to stay with us, but it was almost impossible to arrange that for an individual. We tried to persuade one of the overseers to ask for more permanent labor on the railway, but that too failed. Then one day the extra labor from the camp came without Josek. He was ill and had been put on a working party within the camp. He had a high temperature, and from time to time, when his strength failed him, he had to rest. His comrades warned him when the SS man was approaching, but Josek was too weak even to stand up. He was finished off with a bullet, as punishment for being work-shy. Of all the men whom I knew in those years, hardly one was still alive. My time had apparently not yet come, or death did not want me. When the Germans withdrew before the advancing Red Army, the camp was evacuated, and a column of prisoners and SS guards moved westward to other camps. I went through the terrors of Plaszow. I got to know Grossrosen and Buchenwald, and finally, after countless detours via auxiliary camps, I landed at Mauthausen. I was allocated straight away to Block 6, the death block. Although the gas chamber was working at full pressure, it could not keep up with the enormous number of candidates. Day and night, above the crematoria, there hung a great cloud of smoke, evidence that the death industry was in full swing. It was unnecessary to hasten the natural process of death. Why provide so many corpses in so many batches? Undernourishment, exhaustion, and diseases, which were often harmless in themselves, but which nevertheless carried off the weak prisoners, could provide a slower and steadier, but just as certain, stream of corpses for the crematoria. We prisoners in Block 6 no longer had to work, and we hardly saw any SS men, only the dead bodies, which were carried away at regular intervals by those comrades who still had a little strength left, and we saw the newcomers who took their places. Our hunger was almost unbearable. We were given practically nothing to eat. Each day, when we were allowed a short time outside the huts, we threw ourselves on the ground, tore up the scanty grass, and ate it like cattle. After such outings, the corpse carriers had their hands full, for few could digest this food. The corpses were piled onto the hand carts, which formed an endless procession. In this camp I had time for thought. It was obvious that the Germans were nearing their end, but so were we. The well-oiled machinery of murder was now running by itself, liquidating the last witnesses of the unspeakable crimes. I already surmised what was later to be confirmed,
there were complete plans in existence for our final destruction as soon as the Americans approached the camp.
Only another half hour till freedom, but only a quarter of an hour till death, as one of us said.
I lay on my bunk, wasted away to a skeleton. I looked at everything as through a thin curtain, which I supposed was the effect of hunger. Then I would fall into a restless doze. One night, when I was neither awake nor asleep, the SS man from Lemberg Hospital reappeared to me. I had forgotten all about him. There were more important things, and in any case hunger dulled the thinking processes. I realized that I had only a few days to live, or at best a few weeks, and yet I remembered the SS man again and his confession. His eyes were no longer completely hidden. They looked at me through small holes in the bandages. There was an angry expression in them. He was holding something in front of me, the bundle that I had refused to accept from the nurse. I must have screamed. A doctor, a young Jew from Krakow, with whom I had sometimes conversed, was on watch that night. To this day, I do not know why there was a doctor in Block 6. He couldn't help us, for his whole stock of drugs consisted of indefinable red pastilles and a little paper wadding. But this was enough for the authorities to pretend that there was a physician to look after the 1,500 condemned men in Block 6.
"What's the matter with you?"
asked the doctor, whom I found standing by my bunk. Four of us had to sleep on a single bunk, and naturally the other three had been roused.
"What's the matter?"
he repeated.
"I was only dreaming."
"Dreaming?
I only wish I were able to dream again," he consoled. "When I go to sleep, I wish for a dream that would take me away from here. It is never fulfilled. I sleep well, but I never dream. Was yours a nice dream?"
"I dreamt of a dead SS man," I said. I knew that he could not understand the few words I had spoken, and I was much too weak to tell him the whole story. What would have been the sense of it anyway? Not one of us was going to escape from this death hut. So I held my peace. During the same night, one of the men in our bunk died. He had once been a judge in Budapest. Since his death meant we would have more room in our cramped bunk, we pondered whether to report his departure, but in the end the fact that there was a free place could not be hidden. 2 days later, when a new consignment of prisoners arrived, a young Pole was allocated to our bunk. His name was Bolek, and he had come from Auschwitz, which had been evacuated in the face of the Russian advance. Bolek was a strong character, and nothing could shake him. Little disturbed him, and he retained his sang-froid in the worst situations. In some ways he reminded me of Josek, although physically he hadn't the slightest resemblance to him. At first I took him to be an intelligent country lad. At Mauthausen, nobody asked a fellow prisoner where he came from or what his profession had been. We accepted whatever he chose to tell us about himself. The past was no longer important. There were no class differences. We were all equals, except for one thing, the times of our appointments with death. Bolek told us about the men who perished on the transportation from Auschwitz to Mauthausen. They died of starvation during the endless days of railway traveling, or they collapsed from fatigue during the all-day marches. Those who could no longer walk were shot. One morning, I heard Bolek murmuring his prayers in Polish, which was a very unusual occurrence. Very few of us still prayed. He who is incessantly tortured in spite of his innocence soon loses his faith. Gradually, I learned that Bolek, who had studied theology, had been arrested outside the seminary in Warsaw. In Auschwitz, he endured the most inhuman treatment, for the SS knew that he was a priest in training and never tired of inventing new humiliations for him. But his faith was unbroken. One night, as he lay awake beside me in the bunk, I told him about my experience in the Lemberg Hospital. "After all, they are not all exactly alike," he said when I had finished. Then he sat up and stared straight in front of him in silence. "Bolek," I insisted, "you who would have been a priest by now if the Nazis had not attacked Poland, what do you think I ought to have done?"
Should I have forgiven him? Had I, in any case, the right to forgive him? What does your religion say? What would you have done in my position?
Stop. Wait a minute, he protested. You are overwhelming me with questions. Take it easy.
I realize that this business sticks in your memory, although we have been through so much. But I take it that your subconscious is not completely satisfied with your attitude at the time. I think I gathered that from what you said.
Was this true? Did my unrest come from my subconsciousness? Was this what drove me again and again to think about the encounter in the hospital? Why had I never been able to put it behind me? Why was the business not finished and done with? That seemed to me the most important question.
Some minutes passed in silence, although Bolek's eyes never left mine. He, too, seemed to have forgotten time and place.
I don't think that the attitude of the great religions to the question of forgiveness differs to any great extent. If there is any difference, then it is more in practice than in principle. One thing is certain. You can only forgive a wrong that has been done to yourself. Yet, on the other hand, whom had the SS man to turn to? None of those he had wronged were still alive.
So he asked something from me that was impossible to grant?
Probably he turned to you because he regarded Jews as a single condemned community. For him, you were a member of this community, and thus his last chance.
What Bolek was saying reminded me of the feeling I experienced during the dying man's confession. At that time I really was his last chance of receiving absolution. I had tried to express this view when discussing the affair with Josek, but he managed to convince me otherwise at the time. Or was it illusion? But Bolek continued,
I don't think he was lying to you. When one is face to face with death, one doesn't lie. On his deathbed, he apparently returned to the faith of his childhood, and he died in peace because you listened to his confession. It was a real confession for him, even without a priest. Through his confession, as you surely know, though it was not a formal confession, his conscience was liberated, and he died in peace because you had listened to him. He had regained his faith. He had become once again the boy who, as you said, was in close relation with his church.
You seem to be all on his side, I protested. Very few SS men were brought up as atheists, but none retained any teaching of their church.
That's not the question. I thought a lot about this problem when I was in Auschwitz. I argued with the Jews there. And if I survive this camp and ever get ordained a priest, then I must reconsider what I have said about the Jews. You are aware that the Polish church in particular was always very anti-Semitic. But let us stick to your problem. So this Lemberg fellow showed signs of repentance, genuine, sincere repentance for his misdeeds. That at least is how you described it.
Yes, I answered. I am still convinced of that.
Then, Bolek pronounced solemnly, then he deserved the mercy of forgiveness.
But who was to forgive him? I? Nobody had empowered me to do so.
You forget one thing. This man had not enough time left to atone for his crime. He had no opportunity to expiate the sins which he had committed.
Maybe. But had he come to the right person? I had no power to forgive him in the name of other people. What was he hoping to get from me?
Without hesitation, Bolek replied, in our religion, repentance is the most important element in seeking forgiveness, and he certainly repented. You ought to have thought of something. Here was a dying man, and you failed to grant his last request.
That's what is worrying me.
But there are requests that one simply cannot grant. I admit that I had some pity for the fellow.
We talked for a long time, but came to no conclusion. On the contrary, Bolek began to falter in his original opinion that I ought to have forgiven the dying man, and for my part, I became less and less certain as to whether I had acted rightly. Nevertheless, the talk was rewarding for both of us. He, a candidate for the Catholic priesthood, and I, a Jew, had exposed our arguments to each other, and each had a better understanding of the other's views. When at last the hour of freedom struck,
It was too late for so many of us. But the survivors made their way homeward in groups. Bolek, too, went home, and 2 years later I heard that he had been ill, but I never learned what happened to him eventually. For me, there was no home to return to. Poland was a cemetery, and if I were to make a new life, I couldn't start it in a cemetery, where every tree, every stone, reminded me of the tragedy which I had barely survived. Nor did I want to meet those who bore the guilt for our sufferings. So, soon after the liberation, I joined a commission for the investigation of Nazi crimes. Years of suffering had inflicted deep wounds on my faith that justice existed in the world. It was impossible for me simply to restart my life from the point at which it had been so ruthlessly disrupted. I thought the work of the commission might help me regain my faith in humanity and in the things which mankind needs in life, besides the material. In the summer of 1946, I went on a journey with my wife and a few friends to the neighborhood of Linz. We spread a rug on the hillside and looked out on the sunny landscape. I borrowed a pair of binoculars and studied nature through them. Thus, at least I could reach with my eyes objects to which my weak legs could no longer carry me. As I looked around, I suddenly saw behind me a bush, and behind the bush, a sunflower. I stood up and went slowly toward it. As I approached, I saw other sunflowers were growing there, and at once I became lost in thought. I remembered the soldiers' cemetery at Lemberg, the hospital and the dead SS man, on whose grave a sunflower would now be growing. When I returned, my friends looked at me anxiously. "Why are you so pale?" they asked. I didn't want to tell them about the haunting episode of the hospital in Lemberg. It was a long time since I had thought about it, yet a sunflower had come to remind me. Remind me of what? Had I anything to reproach myself for? As I recalled once more the details of the strange encounter, I thought how lovingly he had spoken of his mother. I even remembered her name and address, which appeared on the bundle containing his possessions. A fortnight later, on my way to Munich, I took the opportunity to pay a visit to Stuttgart. I wanted to see the SS man's mother. If I talked with her, perhaps it would give me a clearer picture of his personality. It was not curiosity that inspired me, but a vague feeling of duty, and perhaps the hope of exercising forever one of the most unpleasant experiences of my life. At that time, the world was seeking for a more precise understanding of the Nazi atrocities. What at first nobody could believe, chiefly because the mind could not comprehend the enormity of it, slowly became authenticated by fresh evidence. It gradually dawned that the Nazis committed crimes which were so monstrous as to be incredible. But ere long, priests, philanthropists, and philosophers implored the world to forgive the Nazis. Most of these altruists had probably never even had their ears boxed, but nevertheless found compassion for the murderers of innocent millions. The priests said, indeed, that the criminals would have to appear before the divine judge, and that we could therefore dispense with earthly verdicts against them, which eminently suited the Nazis' book. Since they did not believe in God, they were not afraid of divine judgment. It was only earthly justice that they feared. Stuttgart, I found, was one great ruin. Rubble was everywhere, and people were living in the cellars of bombed houses merely to have a roof over their heads. I remembered the Kristallnacht, when they were burning the synagogues, and somebody had said, "Today they burn down the synagogues, but one day their own homes will be reduced to rubble and ashes." On columns and walls, I saw notices posted by families who had been torn apart and were seeking to find each other again. Parents were looking for their children, children their parents. I inquired for the street in which the SS man's mother was supposed to be living. I was told that this part of the city had been devastated by the bombs and the inhabitants had been evacuated. As there was no public transport, I set out on foot to pursue my quest. Finally, I stood outside an almost completely destroyed house, in which only the lower floors seemed partly inhabitable. I climbed the decrepit, dusty stairs and knocked on the shattered wooden door. There was no immediate response, and I prepared myself for the disappointment of an unfulfilled mission. Suddenly, the door opened gratingly, and a small, frail old lady appeared on the threshold.
"Are you Frau Maria S?"
I asked.
"Yes,"
she answered.
"May I speak to you and your husband?" "I am a widow."
She bade me come in, and I looked around the room, the walls of which were cracked and the plaster on the ceiling was loose. Over the sideboard hung, not quite straight, a photograph of a good-looking, bright-eyed boy. Around one corner of the picture there was a black band. I had no doubt this was the photograph of the man who had sought my forgiveness. He was an only son. I went over to the photo and looked at the eyes that I had never seen.
"That is my son, Carl,"
said the woman in a broken voice.
"He was killed in the war."
"I know," I murmured. I had not yet told her why I had come. Indeed, I had not yet made up my mind what I wanted to say. On the way to Stuttgart, many thoughts had run through my head. Originally, I had wanted to talk to the mother to check the truth of the story he had told me, but was I not secretly hoping that I might hear something that contradicted it? It would certainly make things easier for me. The feeling of sympathy, which I could not reject, would then perhaps disappear. I reproached myself for not having planned to open the conversation. Now that I confronted the mother, I did not know how to begin. I stood in front of Carl's portrait in silence. I could not take my eyes off him. His mother noticed it.
"He was my only son. A dear good boy. So many young men of his age are dead. What can one do? There is so much pain and suffering today, and I am left all alone."
Many other mothers had also been left all alone, I thought. She invited me to sit down. I looked at her grief-stricken face and said,
"I am bringing you greetings from your son." "Is this really true? Did you know him? It is almost 4 years since he died. I got the news from the hospital. They sent his things back to me."
She stood up and opened an old chest from which she took the very same bundle the hospital nurse had tried to give me.
"I have kept his things here, his watch, his notebook, and a few other trifles. Tell me, when did you see him?"
I hesitated. I did not want to destroy the woman's memory of her good son. 4 years ago I was working on the Eastern Railway at Lemberg, I began. One day, while we were working there, a hospital train drew up, bringing wounded from the east. We talked to some of them through the windows. One of them handed me a note with your address on it, and asked me to convey to you greetings from one of his comrades, if ever I had the opportunity to do so. I was rather pleased with this quick improvisation.
"So, actually, you never saw him?"
she asked. "No," I answered. "He was probably so badly wounded that he could not come to the window."
"How then was he able to write?"
she questioned.
"His eyes were injured, and all the letters he sent to me must have been dictated to one of the nurses."
"Perhaps he had asked one of his comrades to write down your address," I said hesitatingly.
"Yes," she reflected. "It must have been like that. My son was so devoted to me. He was not on specially good terms with his father, although he too loved our son as much as I did."
She broke off for a moment and looked around the room.
"Forgive me, please, for not offering you anything,"
she apologized.
"I should very much like to do so, but you know how things are today. I have nothing in the house, and there is very little in the shops."
I stood up and went over to her son's photograph again. I did not know how to bring the conversation round again to him.
"Take the photograph down if you like,"
she suggested. I took it carefully down from the wall and put it on the table. "Is that a uniform he is wearing?" I asked.
"Yes. He was 16 at the time, and in the Hitler Youth," she replied. "My husband did not like it at all. He was a convinced Social Democrat, and he had many difficulties because he would not join the party. Now I am glad he didn't. In all those years he never got any promotion. He was always passed over. It was only during the war that he was at last made manager, because all the younger men were called up. Only a few weeks later, almost exactly a year from the day on which we received news of our son's death, the factory was bombed. Many lost their lives, including my husband.
In a helpless, despairing gesture, she folded her hands together.
So I am left all alone. I live only for the memories of my husband and my son. I might move to my sister's, but I don't want to give up this house. My parents lived here, and my son was born here. Everything reminds me of the happy times, and if I went away, I feel I should be denying the past.
As my eyes came to rest on a crucifix which hung on the wall, the old lady noticed my glance.
I found that cross in the ruins of a house. It was buried in the rubble, except that one arm was showing, pointing up accusingly to the sky. As nobody seemed to want it, I took it away. I feel a little less abandoned.
Had this woman, too, perhaps thought God was on leave, and had returned to the world only when he saw all the ruins? Before I could pursue this train of thought, she went on.
What happened to us was a punishment from God. My husband said at the time of Hitler's coming to power that it would end in disaster. Those were prophetic words. I am always thinking about them. One day our boy surprised us with the news that he had joined the Hitler Youth, although I had brought him up on strictly religious lines. You may have noticed the saints' pictures in the room. Most of them I had to take down after 1933. My son asked me to do so. His comrades used to rag him for being crazy about the church. He told me about it reproachfully, as if it were my fault. You know how in those days they set our children against God and their parents. My husband was not a very religious man. He rarely went to church because he did not like the priests, but he would allow nothing to be said against our parish priest, for Carl was his favorite. It always made my husband happy to hear the priest's praise.
The old lady's eyes filled with tears. She took the photograph in her hand and gazed at it. Her tears fell on the glass. I once saw in a gallery an old painting of a mother holding a picture of her missing son. Here it had come to life.
Ah, she sighed, if you only knew what a fine young fellow our son was. He was always ready to help without being asked. At school, he was really a model pupil, till he joined the Hitler Youth, and that completely altered him. From then on, he refused to go to church.
She was silent for a while as she recalled the past.
The result was a sort of split in the family. My husband did not talk much, as was his habit, but I could feel how upset he was. For instance, if he wanted to talk about somebody who had been arrested by the Gestapo, he first looked round to be sure that his own son was not listening. I stood helplessly between my man and my child.
Again she sank into a reverie.
Then the war began, and my son came home with the news that he had volunteered. For the SS, of